Hi, and welcome to the Courtney Turner Podcast. I'm your host, Courtney, and I'm super passionate about moving and thinking. On this show, we are going to dive into all things health, fitness, personal development, lifestyle, and political, sociocultural. I've always been fascinated by people, and I love learning from the experiences and stories of others. This has been a treat for me, and I hope this is enjoyable and useful for you. As always, if you have any questions, comments, or any way that I can make this a better experience for you, please don't hesitate to reach out. Hello, welcome to the Courtney Turner Podcast. I'm here today with Amanda Head. She is the founder and managing editor of The Hollywood Conservative. You can see the picture in the background. How are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you?
Pretty good. Yeah. How are things? You're in LA right now, right?
I am in LA. We just passed the, so yesterday was the deadline for the Recall Gavin effort.
Yes.
We needed 1.5 million signatures, but the final count was 2,117,730. So what they've said all along is that like 12 to 14% of them will be invalid signatures. It's funny how much they're scrutinizing these signatures this time around.
But not the election.
But even on the higher end, even if they threw out 17%, that would still put us at like 1.7 million. So the recall election is a go. Now it's just kind of sitting and waiting for that to happen. It will likely be this fall, but Democrats are already trying to pull their dirty tricks and they're trying to push it to the next regularly scheduled primary because they know that Democrats, they have a, you know, more Democrats will turn out. So they're already trying to pull some shady stuff, which is not a surprise. So anyway, we'll see how it goes from here. You know, It's a very strange process. There, basically, when the recall takes place, there are two questions on the ballot. Do you want to recall Gavin Newsom? And who do you want to take his spot? But anybody can throw their hat in the ring. Like, there's no primary process for it. So, like, in 2003, when we recalled Gray Davis, there were 135 names on the ballot. So, it's like the wild, wild west out here, literally.
it really is. And what's so amazing to me is how few people actually know what the process is.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Right? Like people are all excited. They're like, oh, Gavin Newsom's going to be recalled. And they're like, okay. And then what does that mean? You know?
Right. Yeah. And you know, there's a cautionary tale for us because obviously we don't want to have, you know, three or four big name Republicans on the ballot and then dilute the vote among them. We've got to pick one and everybody let's go with that one. So we'll see.
All right. Yeah. So I'm very curious, Hollywood Conservative, you and I have similar kind of backgrounds. You were a singer, I was an actress, producer, and both of us have, you know, moved into political arena. How on earth did that happen for you and why?
Yeah, it's it's an interesting story. I mean, just like you, it's like, you know, you leave that industry and you think that you're going to a more saner, stable industry, but you're really just kind of jumping out of the frying pan into the fire. So basically, you know, I moved out to LA in 2006 to pursue music. I did that for about 10 years. I was in a pop duo with another gal and we had, you know, a really good amount of success. We had two songs on the Billboard Mainstream Top 40, two songs on the Billboard Dance Top 40. We toured the country. We opened at South by Southwest. We had, you know, a good amount of success. And in January of 2016, I kind of had one of these come to Jesus moments where I was like, okay, you know, I'm in my 30s. The whole pop star thing definitely has a shelf life. So I should start cultivating something new that will keep me liquid. So I bailed from music and I kind of had, you know, a little bit of like, I guess grief over that for a couple of days. And then I was like, okay, what am I going to do now? And I've always been very outspoken about politics. Even when I was in the music industry, I wasn't supposed to talk about politics because that was actually part of my contract. You can't talk about politics, religion, boyfriends, things like that, because they want you to appear single, so they don't want you to talk about boyfriends, and then religion and politics, it just gets too messy. So my, you know, I wasn't supposed to be even talking about politics, but my nickname growing up, I'm from Alabama and everybody called me the mouth of the South because I always have an opinion about something. The day I don't have an opinion about something is the day that I have a tag on my toe. So I decided to move into some type of political media. I had no idea what that was going to look like. But January 6th, I think, of 2016 is when I left music. And a family friend of mine who was actually a fan of the pop duo that I was in, we were called Stash. He goes to CPAC every year and he's a big political donor. And I knew him from the political circuit because he had done Fox News and MSNBC and CNN and all these networks because, and for people who follow Supreme Court cases and people who are jurist knowledgeable, a lot of people have heard of McCutcheon versus FEC. And it was a lawsuit that my friend Sean filed against the FEC regarding aggregate campaign limits. And I won't get into all the technicalities of it, but basically he argued that it was a suppression of free speech. Went all the way to the Supreme Court and he won. So he was doing this political circuit and talking on all the networks. So I called him up and I'm like, yo, I am not doing Stash anymore. And he's like, what? And I'm like, yeah, I'm going to go into political media. And he's like, why? And he's like, are you sure you want to do this? Are you sure you want to do this? Are you sure you want to do this? I'm like, yes, yes, yes. So he was going to CPAC that year and he ended up having an extra CPAC pass, a general admission pass, that he wasn't going to be using. So I was like, cool, I'll go to CPAC. I have no idea what it is, but I'll go. So, you know, I immediately go online, start Googling flights, and then I'm Googling what is CPAC. And so I figure out what it is. And so I go on VistaPrint or some like, you know, cheap printing company online. I print off like 1,000 business cards for $10. And I just put like Amanda Head, the Hollywood conservative, because I'm like, I got to find a niche in the market somewhere. And there's this quote that I'm kind of taking a little side street here, but there's this Loretta Lynn quote that she says, in order to be successful in life, you have to be first, best, or different. And so I was like, you know, I'm definitely not the first conservative in Hollywood, although sometimes it feels like I'm the only one. I'm definitely not the best, but I can be different because I knew that I was coming fresh off of a career in the music industry and starting, you know, this politics thing. I knew that I could corner the market on something that was very niche. So I decided to go with the Hollywood conservative. So I go to CPAC and this same friend, Sean McCutcheon, had a booker who booked him on radio shows and on all of the major networks to talk about his Supreme Court case. So Sean calls up his booker and he's like, hey, you know, would you mind just as a favor to me booking my friend Amanda on some radio shows on Media Row at CPAC? And he's like, who? And Sean's like, she's okay. She's okay. She's not going to make you look bad. Like, it's fine. So fortunately, Josh, a booker who's actually still a great friend of mine. He came to my wedding and everything. Josh took a leap of faith and booked me on some radio shows on Media Row. So I did, I don't know, 3 or 4 radio shows. And by the time I got to the end of Media Row, someone from the station that I had done first in the day found me. And he said, we're losing a host. One of our hosts is going to a major network. We have a time slot opening up. Would you be interested in doing a radio show? And I'm like, okay, so that's what the Hollywood conservative is now. It's a radio show. Because I had initially thought, you know, I'll just do like a video blog. I'll do videos on YouTube or something. So then I was like, okay, well, I guess now we're doing this. So that was the end of February, beginning of March of 2016. And by March 30th, I started my radio show. It was on terrestrial radio on one station in Prince of Prussia, Pennsylvania, I think. But it's called Conservative Commando. Yeah, it's called Conservative Commandos Radio. And then I started getting picked up by other radio networks. So that kind of turned into a couple different opportunities for me. One of them was I became the national spokesperson for a super PAC. They're actually the nation's largest pro-Trump super PAC. A lot of people remember them before the 2016 election. They were called Stop Hillary PAC. and they put out all the big attack ads on Hillary Clinton. I think that they are actually largely responsible for Donald Trump getting elected, but they changed their name to Committee to Defend the President, and I became their national spokesperson. So I was doing Fox News all the time and MSNBC and CNN, and that was just whatever. So simultaneously, there's a media company called The Rebel Media. Yeah. And they were started in Canada, but they're really amazing. They're really only one of the few honest news sources in Canada, but they're worldwide. They have people here in the States. They have people in South America, the UK, the Middle East, everywhere. So they were kind of doing a revamp of their whole lineup. They got rid of like six people and then hired five of us kind of like in a block. It was me, Sebastian Gorka, Kurt Schlichter, John Cardillo, and Katie Hopkins. And we all kind of got hired together at The Rebel. Oh. So I was doing this while I was doing the spokesperson thing for the PAC. And then that turned into the network that I'm on now. And in the meantime, I started my website, The Hollywood Conservative. So it's all just kind of been, you know, I always feel like you should have, you know, as many fires going as possible. I've yet to figure out if the best move is to work hard or work smart. I've done both over the course of this career, so I can't actually attribute anything to specific to either one of them. So just do both, work hard and work smart. That's my
message. All right. Maybe working hard is working smart, right?
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. I think there's definitely something to be said for working smart, but I think that you still need to put in hard work. You know, I think it's kind of,
absolutely,
right? Like, I think people tend to, you know, when you say work smart, it's a very gimmicky thing. People are looking for kind of like whatever that quick fix is, you know, that instant, absolutely, gratification. So, yeah.
Yeah. And I think there are aspects of working smart to kind of my synthesis, because, you know, $10 printing off 1,000 business cards was definitely working smart, because when, yeah, I went to CPAC, I mean, I was like an NBA player at a strip club. Like, I was just ATMing those business cards everywhere. And I was just networking my fanny off. But the working hard aspect of it was, I was the first person on the convention floor every day. I was the last person to leave everything at night. And I just worked and networked my butt off. And then, you know, lo and behold, all of these opportunities just kind of started coming. So,
yeah, and that's awesome. What was the biggest surprise in switching careers, like getting into the political sector?
I think the biggest surprise so far, and this is a pleasant surprise, you know, the music career, the Hollywood industry in general, is just super, super gross. And there are obviously a lot of aspects of the political culture that are gross as well. However, all of the women that I have met but all of the women who I have worked with, women who I consider my colleagues in this career, have been incredible. One of our mutual friends, Gina Loudon, I met her at that very first CPAC, and she was on another network at the time, and she would give me one segment every Friday. She gave me a platform for me to kind of like learn and grow, and, you know, just kind of get comfortable doing media and such. The women at my network are all amazing. I honestly, there hasn't been quite so much that feeling of cattiness and backstabbing that you experience in a lot of careers. And I'm not saying that that doesn't exist in our world of political media. It definitely does. I have just been incredibly blessed to be surrounded by women who are incredibly supportive and kind and genuine. And it's wonderful. And that has been a very big surprise, because this industry is very cutthroat. You know, it's pretty savage.
That's amazing to hear. I mean, I've definitely experienced that as well, and I've witnessed that as well. But that's really, yeah, awesome to hear that. What do you think about the current Hollywood culture and how that is influencing our political sphere, our sociocultural sphere? Yeah.
Yeah.
How we got where we are today. Yeah.
You know, how we got here I was talking about this with someone the other day. A lot of people don't know, in 1947, Walt Disney traveled to Washington, D.C. to testify before Congress that communism was taking over Hollywood.
Yeah.
He saw these indicators a long time ago, 70 years ago, or so. And I think that it has just gradually seeped into the Hollywood culture. I think that that has been allowed to happen because culture has just gone in the crapper. You know, Western culture, our country was founded on Judeo-Christian values. This country by and large has always had a very strong up and down moral compass. I think that that society in general here has started to decay with such rapidity that it's hard to really get a handle on it and try to reverse or repair that. Yeah. So I think that Hollywood, I don't know if we can necessarily blame Hollywood, because I think Hollywood is just a symptom of that problem. You know, the whole Cardi B performance on, what was that, Sunday or Monday, whenever the Grammys were, I didn't watch. She is a symptom of societal decay. She's a symptom of a society who glorifies all the wrong things and banishes and criticizes all the right things. Mainstream Christianity, I mean, you know, Christians, as much as a lot of woke pastors don't want to admit it, Christianity is under attack. From the church closings. I mean, the church closings were really kind of that bellwether thing that woke up a lot of Christians, I think. Yeah. But the left hates Christianity because we are the largest, most organized opposition to secular life. And so as a result, they take every opportunity to criticize us. And you know, Hollywood, I hope that their power and their platform is diminishing. I mean, you look at the numbers from the Grammys this time around, I think the numbers were 6.6 million viewers compared to 19 million last year, which 19 million last year blew my mind. I'm like, who the heck are these 19 million
people? Who are these people?
Yeah. But even when I was in the music industry, I've always hated the idea of award shows. It's like, I don't know if everybody had senior superlatives in high school, like best looking, best dressed, whatever, that kind of, you know, that kind of crap. Yeah. And that's just kind of what it feels like. It's like all of the cool kids, the jocks and cheerleaders patting themselves on the back. Why support that? So even when I was in the industry, I've always felt that way. But now, especially the way it is now, I mean, I think most Americans have finally gotten to the place where they're like, you know what? I don't want to be lectured from someone who I deem to be literally morally deplorable. And I don't blame them.
Yeah, for sure. I don't either. And I definitely think that that is exactly what we're witnessing. But unfortunately, I think a lot of people don't know that. And they still continue to look to Hollywood to set the example. And what do you think?
Yeah, I think a lot of that, again, this goes back to society, and this sounds kind of trite, but I think that there's so much truth to it. It comes down to a breakdown of the family.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of the Yin Yang Twins lyrics. Those of my generation will remember the Yin Yang Twins, but there's a song where he talks about the preachers and teachers aren't filling the bleachers, it's the rappers. And that's true. You know, you look at, you know, certain urban communities and the rate of fatherlessness, but also even when you do have two parent households, a lot of times there's no longer a commitment to cultivating a family atmosphere, to cultivating a relational atmosphere between the parents, and kids pick up on that. And when you don't have parents who love each other and love their children, and they show that every day, and they don't take an active interest in their children's lives, then kids are obviously going to find interest elsewhere, and they're going to find heroes elsewhere. So they are finding heroes in places where they shouldn't, frankly, shouldn't even be looking, but definitely not looking for someone who they want to, you know, emanate their morals and their character and their behavior and things like that. And I think that's ultimately what it comes down to. It's the fact that families have been so diminished in American society. You know, I mean, it feels like every other day you're seeing someone make some kind of excuse for single parent households. And look, I'm not saying that single parents can't raise wonderful children and that single parents aren't wonderful people themselves. Absolutely they are. But as a Christian, I have always felt like, you know, it takes two to raise children. And there is a reason that the institution of marriage exists. It is quite literally an institution. And without that nuclear family, I think that you start to run into a lot of issues, the least of which is, you know, looking in the wrong places for heroes. And that's what we're seeing manifested in our children in this, in not only this youngest generation, but even our generation too. I'm not just blaming this on Zoomers. It's millennials as well. So it's really sad to see, but you know, I waited 34 years to find someone. I dated bad boys and jerks my entire life. I finally found a wonderful Christian conservative guy. And buddy, I put a ring on it.
Yeah.
Technically he did, but you know,
we did. You helped him along. Yeah.
I did. Big time. When I was badgering him about putting a ring on it, you know, on your iPhone, you can create shared photo albums. So I would just like drop pictures into the shared photo album with him. So he would get like all these alerts. Yeah, adding pictures to an album.
Wait, like pictures of rings or?
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh wow. Yeah, I wasn't subtle at all.
That is awesome. That is really awesome.
I don't think he thought it was, but it definitely offered him some direction. So
well, I beg to differ because he followed your lead. So
that's true.
Or your
that's
hint, true. Rather. Yeah.
Yeah. So
that is really awesome. I also have to comment on you called them Zoomers. Generation Z, that is awesome. Yeah, I have never heard that term before, but it's very fitting now. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I have some Zoomers who work for my website who handle some of the tech stuff. Mm-hmm. And I call them Zoomers all the time and they take great exception to it, but I obviously mean it in the most endearing way.
Well,
but I'm like, you Zoomers need to get your together.
Get it together. I actually think the Generation Z, from what I've seen, I like a lot of what I'm seeing out of the Generation Z.
Yeah, you know, they politically speaking, they are more libertarian, which I am super on board with. When it comes to social issues, I am very strong libertarian. I don't care what you sniff, snort, smoke, or poke. None of that is my business. Just don't come to my church and demand that my pastor marry you and we're good. I'm very libertarian. And this youngest generation, Zoomers, are definitely more libertarian, but they are also more pro-life. So
yeah,
that's a good thing.
I agree. I totally agree. My, the one of them, I guess, is technically a Gen Z. The other one I think is considered millennial. I feel like these generation.
I know, they're so blurred.
Yeah, yeah. They are. The other day I saw some meme and it put me in as a millennial and I was like, I don't think that's accurate, but they do blur. So, but I always, my sister is actually a millennial. We always joke about this because she's 6 years younger than me. So we're actually different generations.
Right.
Yeah. So, what do you think that we can do about this cultural degeneration and the demise of the family?
From a political perspective, I get on my soapbox about this all the time. I know that people who want to be politically active want to go for those really sexy high profile positions. They want to go straight to Senate, they want to go straight to Congress, but start small. You know, if people paid more attention to state and local government, the federal election every 4 years wouldn't matter.
Yeah, all politics is local.
Yep. And, you know, our founding fathers, in their infinite wisdom, placed so much responsibility and power within the state and local governments. The federal government wanted the founding fathers wanted the federal government to mint money, assemble a military, and protect sovereignty. And that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
Everything else, especially social issues, fell to the states and the local governments because our founding fathers wanted our states to be laboratories of democracy. If you legalize shrooms in Colorado and it works out well for them, you know, they tax the crap out of it and it does well for their economy and it doesn't provide, you know, a health risk or anything like that, great. And then other states might follow. But, you know, this our federal government has become so incredibly bloated, and they have so much power over every aspect of our lives that every 4 years, it is like a panic moment for people, because that is like do or die for a lot of people. And look, this was a very, very pivotal election, but I just always encourage people to, you know, run for city council, school board, anything, state Senate, state House of Representatives, all of those smaller positions, because you can do much more to change at the local level. So that's politically speaking. Societally speaking, I think that, can't remember the author. It might've been Jordan Peterson, or it might've been a Marine whose book I read. I don't know, but it's all kind of the same idea. If you don't make up your bed every morning, then you can't fix the world's problems. Societally, I think that
Jordan
we
Peterson's
have people.
First rule for life is to make your bed. So,
oh, perfect. Yeah. Okay. What I just said might actually be an amalgamation of Jordan Peterson and that other book that I read, but it works.
Yeah.
So, you know, we obviously here in LA, we have celebrities who are giving, you know, the typical pageant answer, world peace. We want world peace. We want, you know, climate change eradicated. And it's like, okay, I get that. Like that in an ideal world, that absolutely would be present. However, you're divorced from the guy who is the father of two of your children, but not the other three. You don't have a job, and your ex-husband, who is the father of two of your kids, is an alcoholic and is in their lives. So maybe fix what's close to home first. So societally speaking, I think that, you know, being a good citizen, and it sounds so dumb, but being a good citizen to me entails a lot of things. It is, and it's not just being a good citizen, like paying your taxes. It's being a contributory member of society, raising a strong family, raising children who grow up to be strivers and dreamers and motivated individuals. It's, you know, I don't know what to say beyond that, but I think societally it starts at home, and we all have to, you know, we all have to look over our own issues and handle our own stuff. And if everybody did that, then the overarching problems would probably, you know, they probably wouldn't go away, but they would be much lesser and they would be more manageable.
Sure.
So
no,
sorry, that was a long answer.
No, and it was a very good one. It's very well said. So you said you were, even growing up, you were very politically outspoken.
Indeed, yes.
Did you always have the same views, or have you gone on a journey politically, or?
I've been on the same path, but I did take a few side streets and then eventually merged back onto the freeway. I've always been on the conservative highway of life. I grew up in the Bible Belt in Alabama. Parents are, oh my goodness, they'll be married, what's today, the 18th, in less than 2 months. It will be 50 years of marriage for my parents.
Wow, happy anniversary. That's amazing.
Yeah. So, you know, Christian conservative parents, and, you know, I was a George W. voter. That was my first vote when he was reelected. I've always been on the conservative route, but in college, I went through a phase where I didn't necessarily change my beliefs, but and I didn't really question them. I just wanted to really kind of substantiate and back up what I thought I felt and believed, and just kind of provide a little bit more of a foundation to those things so that I knew why I believed what I had believed all along. So I read a lot of books on apologetics. I read a lot of books on politics, and I arrived at the same place I started, which is conservative, fiscally, but very libertarian socially, but, you know, conservative overall. And I ended up back at that same place. And when I moved out to LA, I don't know if my parents would admit this, but I think that they were a little worried that I was going to turn into a raging lefty. And I think that there is always a propensity for that. But I think that it also depends on how you've raised your children. If you've raised them with a pretty, you know, stiff spine, LA actually did the opposite. It made me even more conservative than I was before.
Yeah.
And I don't know why that is. You know, maybe that's because you're around a bunch of leftists and you hear them and you witness them try to explain how they feel, and none of it actually makes sense. So you're just like, okay, whatever. And then, you know, you have your own arguments and your own beliefs, and you know, living in the city has definitely, it's definitely moved me further to the right. And my poor husband works in the Hollywood industry, and you know, we go to some of his rap parties and his events and stuff. And I think a lot of those people think that I'm like a Russian spy or something, because they ask me what I do for a living, and I just say I can't talk about what I do in civilian circles. And I do that for two reasons. Number one, to remind them that they are just civilians. They're not anybody special. And number two, to evade identifying what I actually do for a living.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
You can't talk about it in civilian circles.
Yeah.
Awesome. What
it's just like response? A subtle dig.
Yeah, no, totally. What are the reactions you get to that?
Usually it's just like, oh, okay, cool. And then it's like,
yeah.
And I've thought about changing my story to something that's not so conversation worthy, because there is a little bit of a concern that they'll go to someone else and be like, what do you think Amanda does? I thought about just going with something much more neutral and arcane, like, you know, I work in retail or whatever, just so there aren't further questions and inquiry. Right. But it's so much more fun for them to think that I'm a spy.
Yeah.
And frankly, you know, when it comes to enemies of the state, Russian spy and conservative pundit, we're kind of on the same level. So
I couldn't agree more. Yeah. Got a good point there. Yeah. That's funny. Yeah. When I will say LA did the same thing for me. I definitely became more conservative being in LA.
Yeah.
And I'm not really sure. And being in the industry as well, actually, I'm not really sure what that was. I think it's just the constant questioning. You know, because the more question, you know, people ask me, and the more questions I asked of myself, the further entrenched in my beliefs I actually became. It didn't pull me out of it.
Yeah.
It made me more confirmed in what I did believe. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a quote. This is a really lame person to accredit it to, but I think it was Diane von Furstenberg said some quote about love is something comparing love to a flame, and if the flame is really weak, you can easily blow it out, but if the flame is strong, oxygen only makes it larger. Maybe that's kind of how it is for us in our conservative beliefs. We already had a strong foundation, so all of that all that opposition, that oxygen blown in our way, made it even stronger.
Yeah, totally possible. Well, speaking of very strong foundation, I think that this country has a very strong foundation, but it is really cracking at the moment. What do you think some of the biggest threats we're up against are?
I think illegal immigration is probably our number one threat, sovereignty wise. I think that for Democrats, they see that as a cash cow, but not in the sense of money. They see it as, well, kind of a cash cow when you have the votes. They see that as the new up and coming voter bloc for them, because there are a lot of Black Americans who are waking up, and Donald Trump is absolutely responsible for bringing hundreds of thousands of Black Americans to the Republican side. And it's because he was just real. He was real with people, and he actually fought for policies that in raising the tide, it rose all ships as well. And so many people woke up to that. But for Democrats, when they start to see that voter block slip away, then they have to, you know, refill that with something else. And I think that illegal immigration is going to be that. I think they think that is going to be what that is for them. Unfortunately for them, as far as legal immigrants, especially legal immigrants along the border, I mean, those are the folks who are going to suffer the most. You have a lot of Mexican Americans who live, you know, in the El Paso sector and, you know, the border of Arizona and New Mexico and California. And those are the people who suffer because they are in those border towns, experiencing, you know, the the violence and the, you know, the economic downturn for their own communities. And it's really unfortunate to see. So I think what you're going to see is you're going to see a strengthening among legal immigrants with respect to their support of Republicans. And then obviously the illegal immigrants, because they're being promised things by Democrats. That's, you know, it's the bigotry of low expectations. And it's that enslavement that we've all talked about all along when it comes to Democrats. It's getting people, you know, hooked on the teat of government. And so, you know, immigration is definitely the biggest concern for me as far as, you know, sovereignty. But as far as American values, I mean, Saul Alinsky talked about the three areas where progressives and liberals had to take over. And it was Hollywood, media, and academia. And Democrats have done that. They have absolutely taken all three of those. They have hijacked the messaging in our public schools. And, you know, the way to fix that is to homeschool. And my husband and I, we've talked about for years about how if we are still in California, if we are not in a red state, in a red area, in a good school district, then I will be homeschooling my children, which is a very tall order for me. And let me just illustrate for you how tall of an order it is. When I was at Auburn, I was a music major, and the end of my third year, I decided to change my major to business because there was one credit left for the music major, and it was a class where I had to go into a high school and I had to teach music. I literally changed my major and left Auburn without a double degree in music because I did not want to teach. That is how much the prospect of teaching terrifies me and ticks me off, because I have no patience when it comes to people who don't care about the things that I care about. And at the time, music was very important to me. So trying to rattle high schoolers into caring about music the way that I did seemed like just the most miserable thing ever. So homeschooling kids is definitely going to be something that I think God might place that in my life to teach me a few lessons. But I think that the way to wrestle back that narrative from the school system is to homeschool our kids. I mean, honest to God, one of the biggest mistakes that we made as a country is putting government in charge of education. The most idiotic, destructive thing we could have done. I don't know who of our grandparents or our great grandparents or our great great grandparents thought that was a good idea, but shame on them, because it has utterly destroyed generation after generation after generation. The other big issues, I think that we are in a fight right now. And of course it's good versus evil. It's left versus right. But what it also is America first, MAGA Republicans versus the establishment.
Yeah.
If Donald Trump did anything in his presidency, it was to reveal those people in Washington, the people who Republicans who have served for decades, who we have all just voted for because they had an R next to their name. And it was the lesser of two evils. Yep. And we got on by a lot of Republicans. Kevin McCarthy's one of them here in California. I am absolutely ready to get him out of there. I'm not in his district, so I can't vote against him. But you better believe that I'm texting all my friends there and telling them to vote him out. But Donald Trump, you know, he wasn't able to drain the swamp, but he was able to lower the water level just enough to reveal the critters in the swamp.
So that's really interesting you say it that way, because I've been thinking a lot about that. And I'm like, actually, when you drain a swamp, you drain the water and the creatures rise up, right? So generally he kind of did, but people keep thinking it means drain the creatures. No, he revealed the creatures.
Yeah. So I think that that's going to be the battle for our generation. It is finding a way to remove the uniparty Republicans, the people who, you know, the people who literally ran on repeal and replace and then voted against it, John McCain, where you are. Republicans have to start actually, I just wrote an essay about about the Republican Party, and I compared it to the DeLorean from the Back to the Future movies, because a lot of people don't know the DeLorean was produced by a company that was their only model. And the DeLorean, even though it looked super sexy on the outside, they went the company ultimately went bankrupt because the engine was crap. And they couldn't, they knew that they needed to replace the engine, and they were trying to put out another model, but they already had cars on the road. They already had cars in production, and it was basically trying to revamp the company without the wheels falling off. Excuse me. And so I made this comparison about the Republican Party. I said, you know, the Republican Party, they've had their sticker price for a long time, and you list all the specs on the car window. Fiscally conservative, standing up for Christians, standing up for babies in the womb, all of these things that they've listed on that MSRP ticket, that sticker on the car. And they don't stand for a single one of those things anymore. And, you know, it's unfortunate, but it's better that we found out than to keep them in there forever and keep our country going in the wrong direction.
Yeah, absolutely. What do you think about, you know, so you're talking about kind of like cleaning out the people who claim to represent us, but don't, you know, the establishment, you know, the deep state, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
So if we, you know, how do you feel about the integrity of our elections currently and our ability to drain, you know, to clean out these swamp creatures?
I don't know. If I can say this on your podcast, I don't want you to get taken down, but I am 100% positive that Donald Trump won the election. There are pages and pages and pages. I'm sitting here looking at a stack of papers on a desk over there of numbers, of graphs from every single state of illegal immigrants who voted, underage people who voted in more than one state, people who voted from PO boxes. I mean, the list goes on and on and on of fraudulent votes. So as far as election integrity, yeah, I'm really, really freaking worried. However, this goes back to the state level thing. Yeah. The state legislatures can fix this. And you saw, you know, the news report, what was it, yesterday, about a Michigan judge, the ruling in favor of the Trump campaign, basically proving Trump right. And now they're going to unseal ballots in Fulton County, in Atlanta, Georgia. You've got in the state of Arizona, they're subpoenaing ballots, you know, trying to recover ballots. I mean, I think that the 2020 election, for future students who study law or political science, this is going to be a case study for them. But it starts at the state level and the local level for, you know, these swing states that ultimately ended up swinging it for Biden. They had Republican legislatures, but they had spineless Republicans in there. And these are Republicans who could have said, no, we will not certify this vote because we do not know for sure. We're not saying the election is stolen, but we don't know for sure. So we are not going to certify this yet. Right. So it starts with people in states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Georgia, Arizona, Nevada. It starts with those people putting the right people in office who are going to pass legislation. Georgia just passed something through their House of Representatives. I think it's on its way to the Senate, an election reform bill that's going to basically wipe away the stuff that destroyed the election integrity this time around. So every state, every single swing state is going to have to do that. And then maybe there's hope. And I think that honestly, for those who are hoping that Donald Trump is going to run again in 2024, I think that's what he's waiting on, because he'd be an idiot to run again if they don't fix the election process. If they do, I think we might have, you know, I've been traveling around, you know, I traveled with the Trump campaign covering the rallies for the network. Yeah. And I would be really excited to do that again in 3 more years, but we have to fix our elections. We just have to.
What do you think is going to happen if we don't? So I think so. Like people keep talking about 2024, and that's great, but I think 2022 is much more pressing, and I don't think there is a 2024 if we don't get a handle on, you know, this next year and a half. So
yeah, no, I mean, the first step in the process is fixing the elections. And I don't mean fixing the election, like, you know, with Trump's phone call. And he said, find the votes. I don't mean fix the election.
Right, right.
I mean, actually
clarify.
Fix the broken things. Yeah. Yes. That's got to happen first. And then obviously in 2022, I think if we do that, I think that we have a slam dunk chance of taking back the House and the Senate. because I think that, you know, my hope for Joe Biden's presidency is that he does just enough superficial stuff that ticks off people, but not enough to destroy our country. And you know, nowadays everything's reversible. Basically, when you go from Republican to Democrat in the Oval Office, it's like, I'm going to start this policy. I'm going to undo this policy. I'm going to start this policy. I'm going to undo this policy. And it's like, you know, executive orders, unfortunately, have become a way of life. Although Donald Trump signed a record low number of executive orders because he actually believed in the congressional process. But I mean, if we don't fix these things, and it starts with the state legislatures, it starts with those Republican majorities, especially in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Georgia. Those are the four, and Arizona, five states. Those Republicans are going to have to stand up to the mob. They're going to get called racist. They're going to say, you know, they're going to get accused of disenfranchising voters for demanding voter ID. They're going to probably get called murderers because Democrats are going to claim that 2 years from now, COVID's still around. So we got to mail out ballots. They're going to get called every name in the book, but courage is contagious. And if these folks stick together and they do what they know is right, and they listen to their constituents, the people who voted them in office, then I think that we will get election reform passed in these states. We will win back the House and the Senate in 2022. And then whoever the Republican candidate is, whether it's Trump, whether it's DeSantis, whether it's Kristi Noem, whoever it is, that will be a good election for us.
Yeah. All right. I like it. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I'm really curious. Do you talk to people on the left? I know most of them think you're a Russian spy, but you do live in LA. You're in the music industry. So do you run in circles where you're in these kind of conversations? And I imagine either, like, how do you handle that? Do they all not know what you do, or do some of them know? And are you outspoken about it?
Yeah, I mean, the liberals in my life who know what I do, maybe they're scared of me, but like whenever we have political conversations, they're like, oh yeah, I totally agree with that. And I'm like, do you, or are you just trying to knock it in a verbal bashing with me? But my best friend in the world, he's been my best friend basically since I moved to LA, is a Black liberal. But he's very reasonable. He's very practical. He's very thoughtful. And I think I've had an impact on him. I put out a video. I put out these daily videos on my website called The Hollywood Minute. And this was, I put the video like 3 or 4 weeks ago. It was very shortly after Gavin Newsom said that he was going to start gradually reopening California. And so I put together a video and I basically laid out the timeline of closures in California with respect to the numbers of new cases. And one of the points that I brought up was that in November, when Gavin Newsom shut down California again, LA County, at least LA County, this wasn't statewide, but LA County is kind of a microcosm. So LA County had fewer cases, like 2,000 fewer new cases than last month when he decided to reopen. Now, last month when he decided to reopen is when I think he really started getting concerned over the recall effort. So I put out this video, and I also used California's numbers and created a dichotomy between California's numbers and Florida's numbers. And we've all seen them, you know, with respect to the fact that California and Florida have pretty much the same case numbers per 100,000 people, despite the fact that Florida closed much later, much looser, and opened much earlier than California. So I laid out this in a video, and he's wonderful. He watches every video that I put out every day.
Aww.
And he texted me, and I just saw like the preview of the text, and he said, hey, I watched your video, and I couldn't see the rest of the text. And I was actually on air, and I saw, hey, I saw your video, and I'm like, oh God. And I shouldn't roll my eyes. I mean, it's wonderful to have these conversations, but I clicked on the text and he said, I watched your video and I think you're right. And it makes me sick to my stomach. And I was like, ah!
Wow.
I know. And I'm like, finally.
Breakthrough.
So, yeah. And, you know, we have other liberals in our lives. Sure. One of my husband's friends is a liberal and things are a little bit more contentious with him. He's one of those liberals who doesn't like to agree to disagree. So, you know, it is what it is. But I think that the internet, it's always the internet's fault. The internet has been a huge contributor to the demise of civility in this country. And it's because, you know, if I'm sitting face to face with someone, I mean, I debate liberals all the time, literally every week on TV.
Yeah.
One of whom is a guy who is a guy named Robert Petillo, who is a civil rights attorney in Atlanta. He's a Black liberal civil rights attorney. Like, we could not be further apart on the spectrum politically, racially, philosophically, ideologically. Like, right. We couldn't be further apart, but we get on TV together and we actually have constructive civil conversations. But if he was some random Joe who I didn't know, who I didn't have a history of going on air with and debating, and he was just some idiot liberal tweeting at me, you know, there, when you remove that humanity, when you don't see someone's face, when you're not in person with them, when you don't hear their voice, you know, it feels like it's not even a real person. It almost feels like you're arguing with, like, you know, a bot or something. And so people are a lot meaner. I am, by the way. I mean, you go through my tweet replies and I've sent some real nasty ones. I'm not proud of that. I'm not proud of that. But the problem is I wake up in the morning and for whatever it is, I always wake up very combative. So I try to stay off Twitter for 2 hours when I wake up because I just, like, da 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 da.
Yeah.
I get so angry. But, you know, that is an aspect of it when you're talking to liberals, is try to have the conversations either, you know, texting at the very least, but on the phone or in person is the best way to do it. And honestly, it's gotten to the point where sometimes I just don't engage. A girl who used to cut my hair, who I don't really talk to that much anymore, but when the 2 years after Trump was elected, like, every week she would send me some article from like Vox or Daily Cause or like Mother Jones, like uber left sites. And she would send me an article and be like, huh, looks like the orange man has screwed us all. And I'm like, okay, Andrea. So I quit responding and she finally got the picture. And now she doesn't text me about anything, which is actually pretty okay with me. But, you know, there is space to find common ground. I used to say that we all want the same thing, but I don't think that's true anymore. So you have to find other things that you want the same, mm-hmm. which is sometimes hard to find. But it is important to have those conversations face to face, or at least over the phone, because otherwise, if you're just battling liberals on Twitter, that's just not ever a good thing. And look at what happened with, you know, people like Kim Kardashian and Isaiah Washington and, you know, liberals who came to the White House to meet with President Trump. Look at what Kim Kardashian was able to do. I never had an ounce of respect for that chick when she was basically just like a Ray J's porn girl. But she, you know, against all the advice of the people around her, she went to the White House and talked to Donald Trump about Alice Johnson. And what happened? He commuted her sentence. He listened to Kim Kardashian. He listened to her story. And they found common ground on something. And if you're not willing to listen to what you perceive to be a bad idea, how are the good ideas ever going to rise to the top?
Yeah. No, it's absolutely true. Do you think that as a country, we're more divided than we have been in the past? Or do you think it just feels that way right now? Or, yeah.
Yeah.
The reason I'm asking, you said, you know, you used to think we wanted the same thing, but you don't really think that's true anymore. I'm inclined to agree with you, but I'm wondering if you what you think the change is and if there is more of a divide.
Yeah, you know, ideologically speaking, I don't think we want the same things anymore. I don't think that most liberals value, you know, what's the quote? America is great because she is good. America is good at its core. From its founding, America is good. America is benevolent. America is generous. And I don't think that liberals care about the goodness of America anymore. I don't think that they, I think when they think of the founding of our country, because the left has so has been so effective in indoctrinating them and teaching them, you know, the freaking 1619 project and all this bull, you know what, that America is at its core a racist country, that America at its core is an evil country, that America at its core is an unjust country. And I think that because you have people who want to dramatically and transformationally change what America is, who America is, and what America stands for, because of that, I think that we are more divided than we have ever been. I would like to say that it just feels that way, but I think that it not only does it feel that way, but there are these underpinnings of divide that I don't think can be healed with just kumbaya moments. Yeah, sorry, I hate to be the doomsday person, but yeah.
No, I happen to agree. And I struggle with it a lot though, because we should be one nation, right? Like it should be Americans want what's good for America. And so if that's really to happen, there needs to be some sort of healing and not unity in the, you know, phony kind of a sense, but there really does need to be some sort of a common ground. And you would think that common ground would be wanting the best for America. But if one group, you know, has been taught that America is inherently bad and evil, that's pretty insurmountable.
Yeah, I think the way that you overcome that is, you know, I think if Trump had served a second term, I think that even more people would have come over to our side, and even more people would have learned the value of a free market, and even more people would have learned the value of knowing history and not revised history, that even more people who would become contributing members of the workforce and not wanting to live exist in a welfare state. But even more people who would realize that immigration is something that we have to tackle and have to have record of and have under control. But the flip side to that is now that Joe Biden is in office, now that we have a legitimate crisis at our border with border facilities at 700% capacity, with up to 50% of the illegal immigrants being testing positive for COVID, I think that, and that's what I was saying earlier, I hope he does just enough to show people how ridiculous progressive policies are without it actually fundamentally changing and destroying America. Because I think that's the way that we ultimately come together, because I have a lot of liberal friends who didn't vote for Trump in 2016. And because I live in LA and LA is such a melting pot, only one of these people who I have in my head right now is white. The rest of them are Black and Hispanic. And they are people who very proudly voted for Barack Obama twice. And a few of them voted for Hillary Clinton as well. But they came over to Trump's side because they saw that his policies worked. And so I think what we hopefully will find in the next 4 years is a unifying of America around the notion that progressive policies suck.
Yeah, that would be awesome. That would be awesome.
I will sit around a campfire, roast marshmallows, drink scotch, and kumbaya over that point.
Amen. Amen. I did a rant on my Instagram story today about, so there seems to be this trend, and let me know your thoughts on it. It really bothered me. There's this trend, and I'm seeing it mostly from the right, actually, where you see it a lot on Twitter, which is probably not the best place to be having this conversation, but they're saying how it's, you know, smart people versus stupid people, and it's, you know, high IQ versus low IQ. And I really took issue to this because, you know, I typically think that the left is 99.9% of the time wrong. I mean, that's my opinion.
Yeah.
There's always that 0.1% chance, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, even a broken clock is right twice a day, you know? So
that's right. That's right.
But I don't necessarily think that they're all stupid or all low IQ. There are some brilliant people on the left. I don't necessarily think they're right or agree with them, but that's not a high or low IQ issue. And my issue with it is that, one, it's factually, I don't think it's accurate. So I have a problem with that. You know, my website's Truth Matters. I think facts are important. So I don't think it's factually accurate. But two, I don't think it's a smart game to play, ironically.
Because,
you know, it's essentially name calling. And it's not, so this goes to your point, but it's name calling. And I don't think it's productive because the conversation should be about good ideas, good culture, good philosophy, good morals, things that benefit the most people and particularly the most vulnerable. And that is not an issue of IQ. People of all ranges of IQ can support those things or not support those things. And so I feel like you're playing a game where over something that people have absolutely no control over. It's like telling somebody they're short to grow, you know?
Yeah. I think, look, I grew up in Alabama. I grew up in a state where you had a binary choice between Auburn and Alabama, Tigers or Crimson Tide. Mm-hmm. So I grew up in a state where it was one side versus the other side. Yeah. And my parents always taught me, look, Bama has their bad fans. Auburn has their bad fans. Every team has their own bad fans.
Right.
You've got double digiters on both sides.
Yeah.
Double digiters are what I call people who haven't quite reached that triple digit.
I've heard you say that. That's hilarious. That's awesome.
Yeah. But I think for people on the left who by present day standards are intelligent people, first of all, even though I did go to college and graduate, I don't think that college is neither for everybody, nor is it an indicator of intelligence.
Especially
nowadays with, you know, higher education being basically an indoctrination into progressivism. I mean, I feel like the world has really, really downplayed the importance of welders and plumbers and people like that. So I'm pretty much going to forbid my kids from going to college unless it's like Heritage or Auburn. But I think that it's not
Hillsdale,
an issue
maybe?
Of, yeah, Hillsdale. I think for people who are by today's standards, intelligent folks, people who have, you know, master's degrees and PhDs, the people who we hold up in society as these are brilliant people. I think that they get some consumed in the pathos and not the logos.
Mm-hmm.
I think that for a lot of liberals, it's all about the end result. You know, we want equality across America when it comes to schools, but they don't understand that in order to have, you know, good access to education, then there has to be school choice because the government has done a really crappy job with public schools. And for instance, in, you know, certain wards within New Orleans, you have, and oh gosh, we just had a guest on the show who was talking about Baltimore. There are 12 high schools in Baltimore where 0% of the students are scoring on grade level in math. 12 high schools where 0% of their students, zero.
Wow.
How can you not believe in charter schools and school vouchers at that point? Like to me, so this is what I'm saying. It's all about the pathos. It's all about, okay, well, this is where we need to be. And ideally as a society, this is where we should go, but they go about it the completely wrong way. And they don't engage in the logos of the fix as much as they do the pathos. And, you know, when it comes to good ideas and bad ideas, I always make this, I make this comparison. When my husband and I moved into our townhouse, there was black mold under our kitchen sink. And oh my God, it was a nightmare. Like we were literally newlyweds. It was like right when coronavirus started. So you had two humans who had never lived together crammed into a townhouse in Burbank. And now we can't even use our kitchen because the sink is on the same wall as the dishwasher. So they had to pull I'm not a construction worker. Anyway, all that like foundation wood crap, whatever, out because it's not one of those things that you can just like spray it. Like black mold is very toxic.
Yeah.
So we're literally trucking our dirty dishes up to my second floor bathtub, washing our dishes in our bathtub.
I had
beach towels out on the landing drying stuff like it's a freaking redneck garage sale. So that was like the first 3 months of our marriage, but all of this to say that the black mold, we had to expose it to oxygen and we had to pull it out of the wall. That black mold is very similar to bad ideas. You can't just slap paint over the black mold and assume it's going to go away. You have to expose it to ridicule. And the only way that we can allow those good ideas to rise to the top is if we expose them, expose good ideas and bad ideas. Yeah. And this goes back to the whole argument about free speech.
Yep.
My freedom of speech is not to protect you from the nice things that I say. It is to preserve my right to say whatever I want, even if you don't like it, especially if you don't like it.
Yep. Exactly. So. Yeah. And the good ideas you can't see what the good ideas are. I mean, right. Like you see light against dark. That's where you see it, you know?
But that's why the left, I think, is so interested in squashing other ideas these days, though, is because they don't want competition for their ideas, because they know that what their ideas, bad as they are, they know that what their ideas achieve is what gives them more power.
Yeah.
So anything that threatens that has to be done away with. And that's why cancel culture is what it is now.
Yeah. Cancel culture is not new though, but it has definitely, it has gotten much worse. I think a lot of that has to do with technology. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. And you know, I'm actually a big fan of boycotting. I keep a going note in my phone of businesses that I boycott. I haven't had coffee from Starbucks since they said that if you support the traditional family, then they don't want you buying their coffee. And I was like, cool, done. I haven't shopped at Target in a long time. I mean, I'm pretty serious about my boycott. But here's the difference between boycotting and cancel culture, because I do speak out in support of boycotting and against cancel culture. And I know that there's kind of a blurry line between the two. But for me, what boycotting is about to me is the fact that our wallet is the strongest, most vocal, demonstrative tool we have when it comes to sending a message to a business. It is one of the most effective ways for a business to hear the voices of the people who used to be their patrons. Unlike cancel culture, it's not punitive. Cancel culture to me is when it is 100% punitive, even if it's undeserved. You are trying to destroy that person's livelihood. You're trying to destroy their family members. You're trying to destroy their ability to make money. You're trying to destroy their ability to go to a restaurant and not get shouted out like Sarah Sanders. It is a punitive, mean spirited thing. Whereas to me, boycotting is really just trying to use your wallet to send a message to a business.
Yeah. I love that distinction, because I've heard a lot of people make that argument. You know, they say that, well, you're against cancel culture, but you're canceling. But I think there's also another really big difference is the effect, the outcome. So boycotting, it's one person. You have the jurisdiction over how you spend your money and what you choose to support, not support. Whereas canceling is where usually it's the giant that's canceling the little guy.
Yeah.
So it's a very,
yeah. And I think another distinction too, is it's the individual versus the masses.
Yeah.
With cancel culture, there is an effort to, you know, if what's her name, the writer of the Harry Potter series says something, then they try to get an entire community to cancel her. What's her name?
Rowling? Was it? No.
Yeah. You know, they tried to get an entire voter block, millennial, well, not, I guess, Gen Zers, but Hollywood, the LGBT community. They tried to get an entire community to cancel her.
Yep.
Boycotting to me is about, you know what? You can go buy Starbucks if you want to. I don't care. But for me and my household and for what I feel, I'm just not going to do it.
Right. Yeah.
So it's the individual versus the masses.
Yeah. Which I think is a very symbolic representation of the battle that we're up against in this country.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, the individual versus the masses.
Yeah. Sad time. And everybody's like, oh, Amanda, like you know, you always rail on people about running for office and getting involved. You should run for office. And I'm like, I curse too much to ever run for office. Like,
you've done a really good job. You haven't cursed once yet.
Yeah, I get fired up about politics, and it's one of those things that I have to watch myself. But I grew up with two older brothers, and I grew up around men. I grew up hunting with my dad, and it's just kind of a part of my vernacular. But I am trying to be more ladylike. My husband wants me to be more ladylike, and I'm, you know, it's not because he's sexist and he's like, you know, what is it, toxic masculinity. It's not that. It's just, you know, but yeah, I don't think there is an elected office in my future, but I'm definitely going to try to recruit as many people as I can to.
Yeah. So you made a really good point about, you know, running for the less sexy positions, you know, really staying local and making a difference locally. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really important point, because I think people, it's not just an important point for the people who are thinking about running, but I think it's also an important point for people who are trying to support people, because I think that people rush to look at somebody and they're like, oh, they should run for president. And yeah, some people, yeah, right?
Yeah. Like Candace Owens.
Yep. Like she's actually exactly who I was thinking of. Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. I like her.
Yeah.
And when it comes to race issues, she speaks very well on it.
Yes.
But I've seen some interviews where you try to get her out of that race conversation bubble and it's not seamless. So yeah. And I've seen actually a lot of Twitter comments when people are like, should Candace Owens run for president? And people are like, dude, when did this become a thing where like all of a sudden you just decide to run for president? Like, I get it that Donald Trump did it, but that shouldn't be the norm. Like, that should be the exception to the rule.
Well, and Donald Trump also did it. I mean, he's 74 years old. You know, he wasn't like, you know.
Yeah, he has a lifetime.
His first foray into a field, you know?
Yeah. And while I think that there are people like Candace Owens who can absolutely be groomed, for lack of better terms, mm-hmm. into politics, I would just prefer someone who has either a little more life experience or a little more political experience.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's another important point to recognize is the work she's doing in the culture. And that's not to, you know, devalue that, because we need people in different parts of, you know, there's, we need work in politics. We do need work in the culture. We need people in the media. You know, this is a multi-layered front that needs to be tackled. So
and you know, Candace Owens has a large following, but you look at like the demographics of her following, and it's typically like the TPUSA crowd, which there's nothing wrong with that. Turning Point USA. There's nothing wrong with that. However, to really reach the Black community, we've got to have more people like Angela Stanton King. I don't know if you know her, but she's Alveda King's goddaughter. Alveda King was MLK's niece, is MLK's niece. And Angela Stanton King, just to kind of summarize her life story, she led a life of crime. She went to prison. She had her daughter in prison, shackled to a bed. She got out of prison and was offered, you know, multiple different types of opportunities for welfare. And she got on it for a very short period of time and was like, do I really want this to be my life, like for the rest of my life? And she decided to remove herself from social programs and to basically pull herself up by her bootstraps. Now she's hood, and she will admit it, like she is hood, but she appeals, I think, to the Black community more than someone who is, you know, polished like Candace Owens. Angela is very real. She doesn't mince words. And look, I've seen her tweets and I've seen her Instagram posts, and there are some things that she and I differ on. I think that there are some times when she's a little too abrasive about some things. But I think that, and by the way, this is illustrated very, very clearly. She went on The Breakfast Club with Charlemagne the God. And it was Angela up against Charlemagne the God and his two little talking head co-hosts. One was a chick and one was another guy. Maybe there was a second girl. Anyway, Angela like spanked every one of them. It was glorious. Like, she went in there armed with facts, with numbers, with history, with statistics. I mean, she knows her stuff. That's so awesome. She goes in, she does the Breakfast Club with Charlamagne the God. I would encourage your listeners and your viewers to go look up the interview on YouTube. Just Google Charlamagne the God, Angela Stanton King. You look at the comments, and it's, I mean, thousands and thousands and thousands of comments from people who were like, oh my gosh, I never thought of it that way. Oh my gosh, I think she's right. Oh my gosh, Angela just slayed you guys. Oh my gosh, who is this woman and how can I follow her? Oh my gosh, I think I agree with her. I mean, it was incredible. So we have to have, I wish I could clone Angela Stanton King and just like disseminate her all across America to help spread the message. She's great.
Wow. Well, yeah, everybody should definitely go check out that video. Say, what was it again?
So the show is The Breakfast Club with Charlamagne the God, but her name is Angela Stanton King.
Okay. So just YouTube that. I haven't seen it. I'm going to go watch it. That sounds.
Oh great. My gosh. It's so good. It's like, I mean, it's a pretty long video. I think it's like, I don't know, 45 minutes or something. But it's well worth your time.
Yeah, no, it absolutely sounds like it. So speaking of the race war, the culture war, what are your thoughts on that? It seems like the victimhood is the name of the game.
Yeah. You know, again, this is a cultural issue. It is this pathological victimhood. I mean, look, it is a lot easier in life to say that what you did was a result of oppression rather than saying what I did was a bad choice on my part. I get it. That's so much easier. But we have moved into a place in society where you are allowed to be a victim. And sometimes even glorified for being a victim. If you show up to your job and you haven't submitted a report for something, but you're Black, then for a lot of companies, you've been oppressed your whole life, so we're just going to let it slide. And that trickles all the way down through school, you know, kids not turning in school assignments. It's so easy to blame it on someone else and to blame it on the patriarchy or blame it on the big bad white man or blame it on the orange man or whatever the case may be, but that doesn't build character and it doesn't build strong people. And I think that we would be a lot better off if people, you know, for me, the way that I was raised, if there's ever something that I don't get, like if I try out for something or I apply for something and I don't get it, or even if something goes down in my job, I feel like the first thing that people should do is to say to themselves, not necessarily what did I do wrong, but what could have I done better? What was my part in this that achieved this result? And unfortunately, I don't think kids are taught that these days. I don't think that's really like the way of thinking du jour. So I think, you know, I mean, I hate to keep going back to it, but it's raising children who have to be pinned to the wall on the decisions that they make, and they have to experience the repercussions. And, you know, I grew up in a household where I think it was Jeff Foxworthy, the stand-up comedian, was talking about raising kids and kids who are always rambunctious and trying to get into things, and he said, go ahead and stick your finger in that light socket, you won't do it again. It's okay for children to get hurt. It's okay for your kid to fall off a bike and scrape his knee or bump his head or, you know, scrape his elbow. That's okay for your kid to experience pain. But we've gotten into a society where parents are trying to protect their children from every type of pain, whether it's physical from falling off their bike, emotional from a breakup, or intellectual from getting a bad grade in school. And we have to stop with the bubble wrap and the helicopter parenting.
Yeah. Yeah. And they keep moving the goalposts. So the latest I saw was that, you know, the Asians are oppressed. And yeah, that's so, I think next they're going to start virtue signaling with yellow boxes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's but on the other hand, Asians are now a part of white society. So they are also the oppressors, which is why you can have someone who applies at Harvard with the same GPA and the same SAT score, but But if they're Black and Asian, then the Black person is going to get it and the Asian person isn't, because the Asian is the oppressor because they're kind of sort of in our crazy world white.
They call them white adjacent. That's the
right.
Yeah, because that makes
which is moronic adjacent.
Yeah, pretty much. But that's why I said it doesn't. They just moved the goalposts because it doesn't really make any sense. You can't be the oppressed and the oppressor at the same time, right? How does that work? I don't know.
And what if the Asian is Japanese? And their grandparents were in internment camps in the 50s. Like, does that make them oppressed? Is the Japanese brand of Asian oppressed? But then if you're Korean or Chinese, then you're the oppressor? Like, how do we delineate that?
I haven't figured that out. Yeah.
Changing rules, my friend. Changing rules.
Yes. They change the rules. They change the words. We have a lot of that going on right now. Yeah. It's a crazy, crazy time. Well, this is amazing. Do you have anything else you want to add? Any other? Yeah, definitely tell people where to find you. And
You know, politically, I know that a lot of people on our side feel like hope is lost. You know, even if we are outnumbered in this country, hope is not lost for numerous reasons. But I always think about Sam Adams' quote, it does not take a majority to prevail, but rather an irate, tireless minority keen on setting brush fires of freedom. If you care about setting brush fires of freedom in the hearts and the minds of men, we will succeed, because, you know, you look at the American Revolution where, I mean, no one on the globe would have predicted that we were going to lose. I mean, you had the world's military superpower up against a bunch of Yankee Doodle dandies with, you know, homemade muskets. But there was divine providence in that, whether you believe in whether it's God or the universe or whatever the case may be. But Americans, you know, there's a reason they talk about American grit. And we have it, and I don't think we've lost it. And even if we are in the minority, set those brush fires of freedom in the hearts and minds of men.
Amazing. I love that. And I don't know if we're really in the minority. I'm not 100%.
I don't know if we are either.
Yeah. I'm not sure of that, but I do love that. And I think that courage is really, really important right now. And when you talk about, you know, like our founding fathers, they had everything to lose, everything. Yep. And liberty was more important to them. And so they.
Yeah. Courage is contagious. And it's also the virtue on which every other virtue stands. So be courageous, speak out, you know, and I always tell people, you know, speak out about stuff, because there might be a time in the not too distant future where you can't. So,
Speak up while you can. I love it.
Yep.
Tell people where to find you, the Hollywood Conservative, and where.
Yeah. So online, the best way that you can support conservative voices like mine, you can head to my website, thehollywoodconservative.us. We've got a little form there. You can put your name and your email address in there. We send out daily newsletters. On Twitter, it's at Amanda Head. On Instagram, it's the Hollywood Conservative. So I'm pretty ubiquitous.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.